from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, support for Le Show comes from Warner Home Video announcing the DVD release of A Mighty Wind, directed by Christopher Guest. Yes, somebody actually wanted that said, so it was said. But to less important things now, burying the lead. You know, every once in a while I bring your attention to news stories where what I consider the most newsworthy element is deep within the body of the story. In Saturday's New York Times, there was a piece, Bush Seeks More for Iraqi Oil Industry. Story about how they're importing petroleum products to Iraq, even though it's got a big pile of oil there because of all the sabotage, don't you know? Because by the dead enders. And apropos of the big pile of oil Iraq is sitting on, underlining the irony of importing oil there, comes this about paragraph 20 or 22. Who's counting? Iraq. Now, I'd heard, maybe you had too, Iraq has the second. These numbers float around. Russia has large oil reserves. A lot of people do. Anyway, here's what it says in Saturday's New York Times, ladies and gentlemen, paragraph 22. Iraq, which has the third largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia and Canada, has been importing petroleum products since last May. Saudi Arabia and Canada, ladies and gentlemen. So if this war was really about oil, why didn't we just go bomb Canada? Save everybody the trouble. And on a totally unrelated note, it has come to the attention of this broadcast that this Tuesday night, ABC Television is devoting a one-hour tribute broadcast to the late John Ritter, who, as you probably know, died suddenly this past week. Ritter, a star of Three's Company on ABC in the 70s and early 80s, and most recently back on ABC with a show called Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which had been a success for ABC, meaning they didn't have to rely totally on Jim Belushi. And so now, as I say, a special, an hour-long tribute to John Ritter this Tuesday night. It piqued my attention, piqued my interest, because I had noticed that this past August, when Bob Hope died, NBC couldn't be bothered to broadcast a tribute to him. During the summer, when nobody cares about ratings, they couldn't even bother because they had, you know, people eating maggots that they had to broadcast. Bob Hope, who arguably made a lot more money for NBC in his lifetime than John Ritter made for ABC. So, ladies and gentlemen, the lesson is, if you want your network to remember you, die young. Hello, welcome to the show.
When I walk through a jam, no one knows who I am. Put your head on my chest, and I'm Mr. Success. Never closed me a deal. All at once I'm a wheel. Just your head on my chest, and I'm Mr. Success. Why, I once knew a worrying man. He was a hurrying man with never a second to play. He had appointments to keep, people to meet, and it took 30 hours to make him a day. Not for me, not what I want to be. Just your head on my chest, and I'm Mr. Success. Never a second to play. He
had appointments to keep, lots of people to meet, and it took 30 hours to make him a day. Not for me, not what I wanna be. Put my love to the test, that's when I'm at my best. 'Cause with you, pretty baby, standing by my side, I couldn't be a failure even if I tried. 'Cause you make me Mr. Success.
Elizabeth once regaled me with tales of her father, and showbiz old Hollywood, that was the life he had seen. And I sat amazed as she told me of the days of her childhood, and could hardly wait till the time when she'd tell me again. And one day we met, he sat in an old Jewish deli, and he spoke of a young Liberace and spitballs with Victor Mature. And I laughed and I flirted with this old boy who never talked dirty, and the more I suggested, the more he stayed loyal and pure. So give me the old boys with stories to tell of the way this town was, the films that I love that I know so well. These were the heydays. And I cried when he died, 'cause it felt like the end of an era, when the classiest guys were creating an exciting new world. And I thought of the pride in his voice as he spoke of his daughter, how his wife was the love of his life, how he called them his girls. So Elizabeth, please regale me with tales of your father. Oh, Hollywood, that was the life that you knew. 'Cause you're cut from the cloth, you're a chip off the old block, my dear. And I'm glad that I knew him, and I'm so glad that I know you. So give me the old boys with stories to tell of the way this town was, the music I love that I know so well. These were the heydays. Give me the old boys with stories to tell of the way this town was, the films that I love that I know so well. These were the heydays. The heydays.
We'll be right back.
Always a lot of off-air excitement here at the Le Show. I'm from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of Le Show. I was going to play the long version of Stairway to Heaven, but I decided to open the microphone and talk to you, ladies and gentlemen. So here we are. Because I'm allowed to stay. Some nice quotes this week. Some nice quotes I have to call attention to before anything else. Of course, there's been so much else. But before anything else, the state Republican Party had a convention in Los Angeles over the weekend trying to decide whether to ask state legislator Tom McClintock nicely to leave so that Arnold Schwarzenegger could have a clean shot at Cruz Bustamante. Or, in McClintock's mind, whether to ask Schwarzenegger to step aside so that McClintock has a clean shot. And party chairman Def Sondheim arranged the convention so that the two candidates, the two leading Republican candidates in the recall election to replace Gray Davis, if he is recalled, which is a bigger and bigger if as we move along, Sondheim arranged it so that the two candidates weren't in the venue on the stage, on the dais, ex machina, at the same time. And he explained it by saying, quote, "We think it's better in terms of unity to not have everyone on stage at once," unquote. That's the kind of unity I'm partaking of right now, ladies and gentlemen. That's my kind of unity. Get out of here. The get out of here unity. Wait in the green room unity. And, you know, if you ever wonder about the feeling that conservatives have that the people in government really don't understand the private sector, I present to you as kind of Exhibit A for this week, at least, a member of the Santa Monica City Council. They've got this street in Santa Monica, 3rd Street, which after years of death, commercial death, it had been mauled. It had been made a pedestrian mall in the 50s or early 60s, and it just pooped itself way down, and it was a desolate area. And it was revived and made lively, or liveliness was introduced into it. A lot of movie theaters moved in, a lot of restaurants. And since that all happened, the city council has been wrestling with the fact that it's become too successful. So first of all, the crowds were too big. Then there were too many restaurants. Then there aren't enough restaurants because now all the chain stores like Pottery Barn and Old Navy are moving in, and Nike. So now they're worrying about that. Now, if this was just a normal street in a normal town, in a normal world, the restaurants would, as in fact they're doing, move to the neighboring streets. This is 3rd Street. They'd move to 2nd and 4th, where the rents are lower because they haven't been raised by the influx of Old Navy and Pottery Barn. And what would happen? Why, you'd have more lively streets eventually. But no, that's not the way things are done here, or at least not the way the city wants to do them. So the city is trying to figure out now how to keep the entire 3rd Street from going Pottery Barn and Old Navy, and they're trying to keep the movie theaters there because that's a great source of liveliness, all those kids hanging around waiting for the start of Dude, Where's My Car 3. And it turns out the movie theaters are saying to the city, well, sure, we'll stay, but we need a lot of, we need to remodel. We need to modernize. We need more frontage than you allow us. And so Mayor Pro Tem McEwen says this week, quote, "It's kind of frightening that 15 years changes business so much," unquote. Yeah, I know. Pounding away at his Underwood, he says that. That's the city looking at business. Ain't it the truth? Ladies and gentlemen, news outside the bubble. The U.S.-appointed Iraqi interim government said late last month in a little-noticed statement that it would buy electricity from Syria and Iran. a deal that would probably enrich with U.S. funds two countries that top the U.S. list of states that support terrorism. Spokesman for the Bechtel Group, the San Francisco engineering giant that is restoring Iraq's energy grid, says it knows nothing of the proposed energy sale. An official of the Department of Treasury, which monitors countries under U.S. embargo, said he was unaware of Iraqi efforts to buy electricity from its neighbors, but doubted that the United States would veto such a transaction. It could be we regard Iraq as a sovereign state that can purchase electricity from any country it likes, the Treasury official said. That sovereignty would, I guess, come as news to the Iraqis, wouldn't it? A spokesman for the Pentagon could not be reached by the Boston Globe for comment. One day after President Bush delivered his speech asking for $87 billion, senior administration officials for the first time acknowledged that they vastly underestimated the damage to the country's infrastructure, Iraq's infrastructure, and greatly overestimated the amount of oil revenue that could be used to help rebuild the war-torn country. Everybody's been rerunning the Paul Wolfowitz quote from March saying Iraq could basically pay for its own recovery with its oil. The disclosures mark the administration's strongest acknowledgement to date that it failed to fully comprehend the complexities of rebuilding Iraq. That wouldn't be an intelligence failure, would it? How about that intelligence? We'll get to that. There might be the theme of the show. Now they're blaming years of neglect by Saddam Hussein. Left the country's infrastructure in worse shape than anyone imagined. That's the administration's line. That's what Colin Powell said on the Sunday Yak shows today. They don't mention that for 12 of those years, Iraq was under United Nations sanctions imposed for good and sufficient reason, which we knew about. It wasn't a mystery to us. We helped impose them. The admissions seem intended as a show of contrition to congressional critics. So we'll get to apologies in a moment, but that's contrition. What was it Ron Ziegler said? I can't repeat it, but go look it up. Ron Ziegler, the late former press secretary to Richard Nixon, had a three-word description of contrition, which was the first time the non-euphemism for bovine dung was printed in the Los Angeles Times. Those were the days. News from outside the bubble. Intelligence given to Australia before the war warned that the terrorist threat would increase if military action was launched against Saddam Hussein. This contradicts repeated assertions by the Australian Prime Minister. This raises new questions in Australia as to whether their public was deliberately misled in the lead-up to the conflict. This was an assessment by the High-Level Joint Intelligence Committee of Britain, handed to the Blair government on February 10th. It debunked several of the key arguments used by the Coalition of the Willing. The JIC, the Joint Intelligence Committee of Britain, assessed that al-Qaeda and associated groups represent by far the greatest terrorist threat to Western interest, and that threat would be heightened by military action against Iraq. It also said there was no evidence Saddam Hussein wanted to use any chemical or biological weapons in terrorist attacks, or that he planned to pass them on to al-Qaeda. However, it judged that in the event of imminent regime collapse, this is a British intelligence report, it judged that in the event of imminent regime collapse, there would be a risk of transfer of such material, whether or not as a deliberate regime policy. Australia receives reports from the Joint Intelligence Committee. Since the war, terrorists have flocked to Iraq to launch a wave of attacks on U.S. forces and the United Nations. Much more about that. From Newsweek, after Saddam's son-in-law Hussein Kamel, head of his unconventional weapons program, defected to Jordan in 1995, Saddam ordered intensified efforts to hide or destroy blueprints, dual-use technology, and any remaining germs or chemicals. Not only was material stashed or obliterated, but records showing what had been destroyed were also pulped. U.S. defense analysts are paying more attention to a working hypothesis based on stories told by Iraqi captives that no live weapons of mass destruction may ever be found. It's nicer inside the bubble, isn't it? It's It's more reassuring. There was a report this week by a British committee of the Parliament. Now, that means it's of the same party as Prime Minister Blair, which means it's under significant pressure not to embarrass Prime Minister Blair too very much. You haven't heard too much about that report. I'm going to get to it. First, this from the Sunday papers. Jack Straw, British Foreign Secretary, made a last-minute plea to Prime Minister Tony Blair not to go to war in Iraq. It's according to a new book. The book says Straw, Foreign Secretary, our equivalent of Colin Powell, sent a private memo to the Prime Minister just days before the war began, urging him to tell America that Britain would offer support but no troops. Blair reportedly rejected the advice and demanded an assurance that Foreign Secretary Straw would support the war. So it's a straw vote of no confidence. The book is called Blair's War. The British government has refused to respond to the claim. The allegation comes days after the British government admitted a majority of the cabinet were not shown that intelligence briefing, which warned that action against Iraq would heighten the threat of terrorist attacks. The book also claims Blair himself had doubts about the intelligence over Iraq weapons of mass destruction. He suppressed them nicely. The numbers game outside the bubble, the true scale of American casualties in Iraq is revealed this weekend by new figures obtained by the British newspaper The Observer, an anti-war newspaper. They show that more than 6,000 American servicemen have been evacuated for medical reasons since the beginning of the war, including more than 1,500 American soldiers who have been wounded, many seriously. The official figure is, all these figures are floating around. I just throw this out for you, for your listening pleasure. The new figures reveal that 1,178 American soldiers have been wounded in combat operations since the war began. It's believed many of the American casualties evacuated from Iraq are seriously injured. Modern body armor means wounds that would normally kill a man are avoided. However, vulnerable arms and legs are affected badly. This has boosted the proportion of maimed among the injured. There are also concerns that many men serving in Iraq will suffer psychological trauma. Hey, join the club, babe, is all I can say. Psychological trauma. Get into show business. So there is this report. Oh, okay, so here's what John Howard in Australia did say. He told his parliament invading Iraq would reduce the risk of terrorist attacks, despite having received intelligence advice that it would increase the threat of terrorist attacks. Okay, so now here's this report by the House of Commons from Parliament. And first of all, it says that the charge that started this whole foo-foo in England, a BBC charge that the British government, the political side of the British government, had told the intelligence side to sex up the dossier that came out last September presenting the case against Iraq. That's not true. That's what the parliamentary committee said. But it criticized the government's presentation of a claim that Iraq was prepared to launch some chemical and biological weapons at 45 minutes' notice. That was the key claim in the dossier. The committee said the defense ministry in Britain had been, quote, unhelpful and potentially misleading. Potentially misleading. By failing to disclose that intelligence staff had expressed concerns about the way intelligence was used in the dossier. The report on the BBC led to the suicide of David Kelly, who was a intelligence. Oh, you know all this. Or if you don't, you don't care. Anyway, here is our Vice President, Dick Cheney, on Meet the Press, talking about the claim used by the United States in the State of the Union address, based on British intelligence, that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger. They call it Niger. We call it Niger. Here's Dick Cheney on Meet the Press.
Joe Wilson, I don't know who sent Joe Wilson. He never submitted a report that I ever saw when he came back. I guess the intriguing thing, Tim, on the whole thing, this question of whether or not the Iraqis were trying to acquire uranium in Africa in the British report. This week, the Committee of the British Parliament, that just spent 90 days investigating all of this, revalidated the British claim that Saddam was, in fact, trying to acquire uranium in Africa. What was in the State of the Union speech and what was in the original British white paper. So there may be a difference of opinion there. I don't know what the truth is on the ground with respect to that. But I guess, saying I don't know Mr. Wilson, I probably shouldn't judge him. I have no idea who hired him, and it never
came. The CIA did.
Yeah, but who in the CIA? I don't know.
With the CIA. He doesn't know because he never goes over to the CIA like every week. Joseph Wilson was the ambassador who went over and reported back to the CIA a year and a half ago that it was bogus information that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium from Niger. So Dick Cheney said the British Parliamentary Committee revalidated it. That's his word. So I went and checked what the British Parliamentary Committee actually did. It said it's possible. This is all right. I have two accounts here. One says the Parliamentary Committee said it's possible that Saddam had attempted to buy uranium from Niger. The committee said, we've questioned UK intelligence services about the basis of their judgment and conclude that it was reasonable. Not that it's true, not that it's valid. Reasonable and possible from that report. Another report, they concluded that the discredited claim that Iraq tried to buy uranium from Niger was probably true after seeing sensitive intelligence cleared only for the highest level. So probably. And possible. Probable and possible is validation in the vice president's eyes. Oh, to have his eyes.
Saudade faz voar, dona dos meus sonhos, faz um mundo quente, semeia semente, sempre surpreendente. Thank you.
This is Le Show, and now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Some good ones, some we've waited for a long time. How about the presidents of Serbia, Montenegro, and Croatia have apologized for the actions of their citizens in the 1991 through 95 war between the two countries. The surprise remarks came during the Croatian president's first visit to Belgrade since the conflict, sparked by his country's declaration of independence from Yugoslavia. As president of Serbia and Montenegro, I want to apologize for all the evils any citizen of Serbia and Montenegro has committed against any citizen of Croatia, said President of Serbia Marovic. His comments prompted Croatian President Mesic to rewrite a prepared speech and add his own apology. In my name, I also apologize to all those who have suffered pain or damage at any time from citizens of Croatia who misused or acted against the law, he said. The war left around 21,000 people dead and more than a quarter million displaced from their homes. It's not clear if they're official government apologies or more personal symbolic statements. The personal is the symbolic? Is that what they're saying? Australian Prime Minister John Howard did apologize to Iraq whistleblower Andrew Wilkie for suggestions emanating from his office that Wilkie was unbalanced. It is the case that a remark made by a member of my staff without my authority, which subsequently and immediately drew a reprimand, was interpreted by some members of the press as reflecting on the character of the gentleman in question, he said. They're not views that I hold and are not views I endorse, Howard said. Wilkie was given a personal apology by Howard's chief of staff. Indiana's attorney general is investigating a local company's two-year delay in distributing more than $200,000 in charitable donations for families of victims of 9/11 attacks. Trends International, which makes and sells posters, raised the money with patriotic posters featuring images including the Statue of Liberty and the U.S. flag. A dollar from each sale was to go to family members of people killed in the attacks. Thursday, the company apologized for the delay, said the funds would be distributed by the end of this month. Attorney General Steve Carter said they've not had any complaints filed on the company. Well, that's actually Carter's spokeswoman saying that. But we will contact the company and do an inquiry into what's going on with the funds. Bradley Roeder, finance director for Trends, issued a statement explaining the money was retained after the United Way said in January 2002 it would no longer accept donations for its September 11th fund. Trends did not anticipate this event. It was unable to donate the funds as originally intended, he said. Don't know who to write the check to, ladies and gentlemen. After describing himself as a former marijuana user who beat drugs by learning to dance the salsa, Tommy Chung told a federal judge this week he's now a role model for young people in Los Angeles and wants to help them stay off drugs. His lawyers were hoping for a community service sentence as punishment for distributing thousands of bongs and marijuana pipes online through his California company Nice Dreams. Chong goes to prison instead, 9 months in a federal penitentiary and a $20,000 fine. As part of the sentence, he forfeits his internet domain name, chongglass.com, and all of the drug paraphernalia seized by federal agents. He apologized for his conduct and said he had tried to make amends by instructing young people in inner city L.A. to dance and learn about the movie industry. Yeah, that won't make him want to do drugs, learning about the movie industry. The Tropicana Casino Resort in Atlantic City put Fidel Castro and his cigar on a billboard touting its Havana-themed expansion. Responding to incensed Cuban Americans from New Jersey to Miami, Tropicana officials said they would alter the peach-colored billboards that feature the likeness of Castro and the words, "The Next Revolution." His image will now have a circle and a slash through it, and the slogan will be changed to, "The Real Revolution." "Our apologies are extended and have been extended," said a spokesperson for the casino. "It will be changed in a way that will indeed be acceptable to the Cuban American community." A casino apologizes, ladies and gentlemen. That's big news. The mother of the 12-year-old girl who downloaded nursery rhymes. Did you know that? That's what she downloaded. The 12-year-old girl who was sued by the record business. She downloaded nursery rhymes from the internet. Does that not make the record of the industry look as good as they really are? The mother apologized and paid $2,000 to settle the legal action brought by the American music industry. Brianna Lajara was threatened with a possible fine of, I don't know how much. Sylvia Torres, the girl's mother, said in a statement, "We understand now that file sharing the music was illegal. You can be sure Brianna won't be doing it anymore. I'm sorry." Her daughter added, "I'm sorry for what I have done. I don't want to hurt the artists I love." What about Yanni? Rafi? Who? U.S. military has offered its condolences and a full apology for the incident in which now a dozen Iraqi police men were killed in Fallujah by Americans. "It was late at night. It was dark," said head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Richard Myers on the Sunday Yak shows. Anyway, the U.S. has apologized. The U.S. has apologized for that, trying to keep the protests in Fallujah down to a low boil. The British Army has apologized to an Iraqi town after a number of people who were injured while being wrongly arrested by troops looking for the killers of six Brits. As well as a written apology, several $100 in blood money has been paid to the suspects, all of whom suffered minor injuries. I don't think the United States has offered money for the Fallujah police yet. At a speech at the Economic Club of Toronto, Premier Kakfui of the Northwest Territories apologized for remarks he made about De Beers in New York, saying they were inaccurate. "I have apologized." He had said De Beers was trafficking in dirty diamonds. He's apologized for that. The city of Denver will pay $50,000 to settle claims filed by 18 people after police raided a Hell's Angels clubhouse in 2001 and detained other members of the group earlier this year. The city attorney would not reveal what led to the proposed settlement. The motorcycle riders complained that some of them were forced to partially disrobe so that tattoos and scars could be photographed. As a result, the lawsuit said, the bikers suffered emotional distress, humiliation, loss of enjoyment of life, and other pain and suffering. They don't like people seeing their tattoos. I get it. I misunderstood. I really did. Mobile phones could cause a whole new generation of today's teenagers to go senile in the prime of their lives, new research suggests. The study, which warns specifically against the intense use of cell phones by youngsters, comes as research on their health effects is being scaled down. Professor Leif Salford, who headed the research at Sweden's prestigious Lund University, says the voluntary exposure of the brain to microwaves from handheld cell phones is the largest human biological experiment ever. And he's concerned that as new wireless technology spreads, people may, quote, drown in a sea of microwaves. Previous concerns about cell phones have concentrated on the possibility the devices may heat the brain or cause cancer. The heating is believed to be too minor to have an effect, and hundreds of cancer studies have been inconclusive. As a result, the U.S. cell phone industry has succeeded in cutting research into the health effects. But Professor Salford and his team have spent 15 years investigating a different threat. Their previous studies proved radiation could open the blood-brain barrier, allowing a protein called albumin to pass into the brain. Their latest work goes a step further by showing that that process is linked to serious brain damage. It said the long-term effects were not proven, and it was possible the neurons would repair themselves in time. But he said neurons that would normally not become senile until people reach their 60s, may now do so when they're in their 30s. So they'll be pierced and senile. A $20 million budget shortfall is caught forcing cuts at U.S. ports of entry that could impact security, according to MSNBC.com. But in case you're wondering where your news is coming from, let me read the trades for you. This is actually from a project at Stanford called Grade the News. I'll read it for you. The three-minute cover story on the January 15th news looked like a powerful local investigative report, just what you'd expect from a trusted news source like NBC. But little about the story was as it appeared. NBC 11's consumer expose purported to reveal a secret credit bureau that may be collecting your information and selling it without your knowledge. And that information anchor Brad Hicks warned was so suspect that viewers were urged to contact the credit bureau to be sure it hadn't ruined their credit rating. Each claim was misleading. The company Innovus isn't secret. It doesn't report to those who might approve your car or house loan. And it's received far fewer complaints than its competitors. NBC 11 might have discovered that if it had done any of its own news reporting, but that night, Hicks was more actor than reporter. He appears to have merely reshuffled a script produced by a low-profile content provider in suburban Atlanta that distributes canned video news. For decades, television stations have quietly outsourced portions of their local news program. But in the last 5 years, scores of broadcasters around the country have discovered a resource that helps them serve up prepackaged stories, leaving viewers with the impression that journalists in their communities did much of the research, writing, and on-camera interviewing. NBC 11, the NBC station in San Francisco, defends its uncredited use of canned news. Says Jim Sanders, the station's vice president of news, what becomes important for the audience is where they're getting the information, not where you, the journalist, are getting it from. 20 years ago, stations always identified video from other stations, networks, or other providers. No longer. Many prefabricated stories contain no local sources at all. The outside production company NewsProNet interviews people across the country, then deliberately omits the sources' locations, even screening out regionally distinguishable scenery and accents. NewsProNet says it picks its story topics based on market research. The company claims these stories boost ratings among viewers with good customer potential, each one impact-tested, capital I, capital T, for audience appeal. One producer at NBC 11, who asked not to be named, said management sets no guidelines about how to identify outside material. Quote, I assume that there are no rules, because if there were, we'd be breaking them all the time, unquote. Stories come complete with scripts and tape, graphics and music soundtracks. Though adding local content is possible, the station's promotional literature advises stations need only add a local voice and it's ready to air. The world is getting more generic. It's clear, ladies and gentlemen, every time I read the trades for you, a copyrighted feature. From the Washington Post, Pentagon sources report one sign that the military is thinking creatively and unconventionally about Iraq. The Pentagon Special Operations Chiefs have scheduled a showing in the Army Auditorium of the Battle of Algiers, a classic film that examines how the French despite overwhelming military superiority, were defeated by Algerian resistance fighters. It may be just the first of an ongoing series of Pentagon film screenings.
All right, what do we think? General Myers?
Too long.
General Schoonmaker?
I thought it raised some interesting questions.
Such as?
Well, why, if Kurtz was such a powerful figure that he could just suck Willard in, he couldn't get out of the friggin' jungle?
Well, it's simple. It's not in his character arc.
Mm.
But from that point where he did the turn, I'm sorry, I was out of there.
You know, I wonder if Brando's persona was so powerful, you just assumed the character was powerful.
Well, to me, he never stopped being Brando.
Did anyone else think the music was severely over the top?
No, well, you know me and music. I think Percy Faith is on the edge. I'm more a Hugo Winterhalter man myself. What do we think we can take away from this?
Well,
I don't think the Doors have aged well.
That you can never have too much chopper footage.
No. Was that young kid? Was that Lawrence Fishburne?
Yes, very early Fishburne.
What about the ending? Was that him burning down the settlement?
No, precisely not. It's just footage of the set being destroyed after filming was completed.
Really?
Yes, the Philippine government wanted it destroyed.
This was before the Universal Tour got so big.
Oh my God, yes. Mm. If they'd left it standing, it would be by far the biggest tourist attraction in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it just completely changes your attitude toward Willard.
Mm.
To the point where if we weren't on such a tight schedule, I'd almost want to see it again.
Well, you know, here's what gets me about watching this.
Mm-hmm.
These people conducted a decades-long guerrilla war culminating in the humiliating withdrawal of American force.
Yes, sir.
And now, 30 years later, we've got them making our sneakers. So, you know, who really won that war?
Now, do I remember correctly, he shot this in 70mm and then bumped it down?
I think I read that, yes. I'll tell you what I think. The filmmaker had enormous cost overruns, and still, look what he came up with. And I draw the following conclusion. We stay the course, whatever it costs. We may well end up with a masterpiece, too.
Very good.
Mm.
That's very good.
Well, sue me, I still think it wasted about 47 minutes of my life I'm never going to see again.
Okay, fine. Now, I'm going to assert a cabinet prerogative here. If it's all the same to everyone else, we have lunch first, and then afterwards it's a dealer's choice, platoon, or Ernest goes to the army.
When you think you found something worth holding on to, we reaching for attention, hoping she would notice. You collecting bottles and thrown away cans, like she was returnable, one day would refill your hands. How she loved you, all you imagined, fit so well into your plan. Sitting there watching time fly past you. Why do tomorrow what you could never do? How she loved you, all you imagine, all the shit you put her through. Maybe one day soon it'll all come out, how you dream about each other sometimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, across, up and down, no, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, and around the world via the internet at two locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like business not changing so much in 15 years if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show playlists, ordinarily available at harryshearer.com. Support for Le Show comes from Warner Home Video, announcing the DVD release of A Mighty Wind, directed by Christopher Guest. And, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be on tour with those very people, so I'll talk to you next week from somewhere on the road. Don't know yet where. Maybe Charles Carroll's old place. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as up to date with business and the home of the homeless.